All right. Thank you so much, Alana. Great to be with you all. Thanks for joining us here Monday night, Spirit Rock. Delighted to be with you. If it feels comfortable, and I didn't actually check if this was okay protocol-wise, but if you feel so moved to just put in the chat where you're joining us from, always a treat to see geographically what our spread is. And maybe if it's your first time here, let us know. And maybe a word or two about how you're doing, what you're sitting with, just to kind of get a vibe check in our temple this evening. My name is Grace Fisher. I host the Thursday Women's Class weekly, which is always an honor, and just delighted to be sitting with you all tonight. So Portland, Bozeman, Roseville, Claire, KL and Maria in Seattle, great to see you here. Occidental Bud, great to have you here. Good morning, Kylie from Australia. Awesome. One of my favorite things about our time on Zoom is just this global spread that we now have. It's just amazing. Chris in Roseville, in San Francisco, great. Rebecca in Oregon, beautiful. Carolyn, welcome back. And just to take a moment just to kind of peruse where our Dharma siblings are joining us from this evening. I'm actually in Lexington, Kentucky. So delighted to be with you. Nice spread all the way around. Leslie in Mill Valley, Kat, welcome, Vancouver, Maggie and Katati. Beautiful. Those of you who are new for the first time, the arc of our time in a few moments, we'll just move into the sit, which will be about half an hour-ish. And from that time after the sit, we'll take a little bit of a break. We'll come back. I'll talk for a bit. And then we'll have a chance for questions and answers or comments if we feel so moved. So just wanting to extend a deep welcome to all of you and appreciation for being with you all. And how about if we close our eyes? So with the Zoom world, we've sort of lost the art of transitions. So I want to have this few moments before we dive into the actual sit just to arrive. For those of you who remember or were ever able to be on the land of Monday nights, there was the whole transition from the parking lot to the hall to the bookstore to get tea and all of that. And sort of wanting to extend just a few minutes here to let yourself let go of whatever you were just in the middle of 5 minutes ago. For some of you, it's early morning. Late at night, we're sort of all over the place time-wise, time zone-wise. So just letting yourself check in with where you are in your day energetically. What can you put outside the temple doors, as it were, that could allow you just to arrive and be present to yourself, to this moment? You have already committed. And we get to be in this retreat together this evening. The hardest part is over. You've shown up. So allowing there to be the sense of arriving, feeling the points of contact with the chair, the cushion, the floor, the couch, the bed, whatever your body is resting upon. Again, feeling those points of contact, perhaps what the sit bones are resting upon, where the feet are. It may be helpful to have a hand to the heart, hand to the belly, and just arriving here. And for the anchor of our sit tonight, I'd like to encourage us to stay in this theme of arriving in this body of ours, this fathom-long form, which is said to hold all of the teachings. The mind does what it does, and telling stories and judging and comparing and making lists and generating thoughts. Okay, so that's what the mind's doing. And can we direct and allow the attention to drop down into the body, lingering here, again, if it's helpful to have the hands at heart center, both hands. Just lingering here and in this space of the heart center, checking in, how's the heart? And as I said, the anchor for our sit tonight is staying with the body. And for some, this might look like being with a breath, that half of an inhale, or the inhale, the exhale, this wind element, this movement of the breath. I like the invitation of just the sort of the half breath is focusing on the in breath and then the out breath as it sets a low bar. It feels achievable just to see how it is to pay attention of that in breath, that out breath. And for some of us, the breath is not a neutral anchor. And if it doesn't work, let it go. And see how it is if we expand the lens a bit to the body, just to feel how is this body resting here on this morning for some, afternoon perhaps, evening. And can we just extend this gentle curiosity? Oh, it's like this. This breath is like this. This body feels like this. Setting down the judgments, the wish that it were otherwise, the feeling that it should be otherwise. And setting the intention just to relax into, oh, in this moment, this body feels like this. Heart is like this. The movement of the breath is like this. Again, setting down the need for things to be otherwise. And please remember, there's no such thing as a bad sit. We come, we take our seats, and we open up how it is to be alive in this moment, to be curious. Oh, in this moment, it's just like this. you for ringing the bell, and lovely to sit with you all. We are going to take a little bit of a break, what, about 5 minutes, I think? And we'll come back, 5-7 minutes. We'll come back. Lana, do you ring a bell to bring everyone back? Is that how it works? Well, there'll probably be a clock. So let's say 5 minutes. We'll come back, and then we'll move into the talk. Thanks so much. Enjoy your break. Have some tea. And if you can, see if you can resist the urge to jump on your phone or check email and just let yourself stay on retreat. Even perhaps stay in silence, have some tea, just enjoy the sweet resonance of our sit together. Okay, see you soon. Thanks. All right, my dears. Welcome back. I hope, however, that very short break went, that you got something nourishing. And again, just welcome back. And it might take a bit for everyone else to join us. Those of you who don't know me, I tend to bring in a lot of references or in poems. And just so you know, at the end of the talk, there'll be a list of all the references. So if you miss something, just don't worry about it. On that reference list will also be a link to my website. I'm a psychotherapist. I have an online practice. So that information will be on the reference sheet as well. So just see what lands. Don't worry about what doesn't land. And tonight, what I wanted to share with you is the idea of the warrior heart. And I'm spelling that W-A-R-R-I-E-R, not with an O. Not the worrying heart, but the warrior heart. And how complicated it is to live in this world, in these times, as I'm sure every age has said this, but this way of being able to live in a place of congruence with our heart, our gut, our mind, and being able to move in this place of coherence and resonance. And I want to talk about this in part just to bring some of myself in here. Last November, and some of you know this who sit with me, I got really sick from mold poisoning, mold exposure. And the way the most long lasting symptom was really high blood pressure. And by high, I mean like high. according to Dr. Google, I was, moments away from having a heart attack, which every medical Western doctor was like, your heart's fine. But it was very humbling as a meditation teacher to be sitting with really high blood pressure. And I kept thinking, I should be able to meditate my way down or be able to bring my blood pressure down. And I couldn't. And the sense of it being so high at times, I felt like I was just crawling out of my skin. And some of you may have had experience with high blood pressure, and it's unpleasant. A lot of sitting with that second beta of like unpleasant, unpleasant, unpleasant. And the practice, it was really hard for me to sit. I did a lot of walking meditation. I've taken up Qigong. So lots of ways of working, but this way of this, what would recurringly happen in my mind, I'm like, my heart hurts. And both there was the physicality of the heart, and then every other component to the heart, and have led me to sort of do a dive into, what is this organism of ours, this heart? And I want to share a little bit from a couple different books, just on the physical quality of the heart, the electromagnetic impulse of in our bodies. I'm going to pull a quote from this book. Dr. Paul Parcel, he wrote a book called The Heart's Code, and I'm going to share a story from him in a little bit, but he's a cardio psychologist and talks about cardio energetic and the cardio energetic portrait of the heart and the subtle energies of the heart. And I'm going to share some of this and just sort of, again, don't worry about it, but just take in, see what lands. But the heart is our most powerful organ. It's the largest generator of the electromagnetic energy in our body. It's about 60 times greater than the electromagnetic of the brain, according to the Heart Math Institute. The heart responds directly to our environment. It contracts when there's an electromagnetic It contracts when an electromagnetic is placed near the heart. The heart responds. The heart is a conductor of energy in all the body's cells. The subtle form of energy emitted, conducted and received by the heart is sufficient to cause changes in the cells of the body, this info-energetic cellular memories. So this information that comes into the heart goes out, and that the heart touches all parts of our body, all the different cells. The heart is a dynamic system. It's open, fluctuating, and interacting system. The heart is the body's primary organizing force. The quote, it holds us together. It uses this info energy connect to our brain and the body, and works in coordination with the brain, but is not directed by it. And in fact, some of the reading really points to the heart is really directing the whole show. The heart is the body system's core. The heart's constantly pumping information to and from and within every cell of its body. The heart speaks and sends information. All hearts exchange information with other hearts and brains. There's a constant resonance. Energy sending heart blends with the energy of the receiving heart. And there was a study from a different book. There's a heart cell here and a heart cell here in the petri dish. And left to their own devices, they just would beat independently. But we brought in a couple more, and then these cells would just beat in rhythm with each other. They came into coherence, into resonance. I think this is obvious, but I want to make clear, I'm not a cardiologist. This is not my area of expertise. I've just been reading about it. So just bear with me on that. Exchanged, and then transplanted hearts come with their own info energies, that is cellular, memory, subtle effects of a personalities and consciousness, and more on that later. But this notion of the electrical magnetic field of the heart, and yeah, and kindergartners are told, like, stay in your hula hoop of your personal energy, sort of that the arms without, sort of that the resonance of the heart, the electromagnetic field, comes out about 3 feet. So we interact with others that way, and sort of heart energy, checking out heart energy, but this way of our own sort of protected space. And in this book called The Heart-Mind Matrix by Joseph Chilton Pierce, and again, the references you'll have, there were two studies that I just thought were so interesting. And I tried to get the actual citation to read it, to read the actual study, but I couldn't find it. A study by two scientists, Rauscher and Van Buys, put sensors in the earth to detect what the electromagnetic field might be in order to anticipate earthquakes or volcanic movement. The ruptures in the physical earth are not reflected in the earth and just her ionosphere, but also in advance of such disturbances on an actual personal and physical sensory level. This was discovered when the scientists found both sensing stations showing some shift in the planetary frequency fields occurring in the advance of earthquakes, right? So they could tell something was going to happen. Far greater implication anomalies were found in a 9/11 case for the Twin Tower disaster, which happened September 11, 2001, was clearly forecast in two scientists' recordings showing the same significant changes in the Earth's magnetic fields and ionosphere as found in severe quakes as the 1980 Mount St. Helens eruption and the later tsunami in 2004. That the 9/11 showed up in the magnetic images was in itself an enigma enough, but far more significantly, the 9/11 event was recorded in advance of the actual physical calamity itself, as had been found with earthquakes. There was an anticipation that something was going to happen. As mentioned earlier, such patterns of negativity with our body, our brain, our heart interactions have already been induced in subjects recorded in the HeartMath Institute. The theory being that there was an anticipation, an intuitive knowing something bad was going to happen before the nine that impacted the humans. Anticipation impacted the Earth's electromagnetic field. It said later that with all the news, the 9/11, the images across the globe, sweeping up every form of media for days on end, repeated ad nauseum, all this planet-wide attention and the resulting emotion created a negative field effect of serious planet-wide force, indistinguishable from other planetary physical disruptions, and temporarily bringing corresponding shifts in the Earth's magnetic field. So we resonate, our own bodies resonate, we resonate with each other, and we can have an, according to this, we can have an impulse on the electromagnetic field of the earth. Right? We are powerful beings. There's a mind experiment in this book. Subjects or volunteers can participate. They're sort of hooked up to the study brainwaves and study heart waves. And they're given an image. The way this the experiment is set up, they're sitting in front of the computer. Someone will press a button to get an image. And there's a 7 to 10 second delay of when you press the button and when the image comes. And the image is either going to be pleasant or seriously unpleasant. But again, the key being that there's 7 to 10 second gap. So sitting there, press the button, I'm hooked up. After a certain time, the heart starts to anticipate what image it's going to be, whether it's positive or negative. I'll read it from here. Anywhere from 4 to 7 seconds before the selection is actually made by a timed random device, so it's computer generated what the images will be. The electrocardiogram of the subject heart shows a decisive shift in the heart's frequency pattern according to the nature of the upcoming image, which is yet to be selected. The shift of the heart pattern activates a near instant corresponding shift in the frontal brain, which then follows the heart pattern and the frequency of the action taking place. The heart action proceeds, if only by a fraction of a second, following the frontal brain. So the heart responds outside of our awareness, sends a message to the brain that it's either going to be something positive or something negative. So this precognitive ability that the heart is keyed into, there's this intuitive knowing of the heart. The heart-brain shift and the resulting pattern of activity is decisively different when a positive image will be flashed on the screen at the end of 10 seconds, as opposed to when there's a negative screen. It's like there's already a knowing. The viewing subject is unaware of the heart-brain precognitive responses and is personally aware of and responsive only to the actual image itself. So much is going on in this heart of ours. To come back to the book on the heart's code, some of you who have been sitting doing the Monday nights for some time might remember the story, because I know Jack Kornfield and Tara Rockwood sometimes share the story, and I've always loved it. So I wanted to share it. Forgive me, it's on my phone. So this book, The Heart's Code, it talks a lot about what happens when in the course of heart transplants and the impact that particularly the heart, but sometimes he talks about liver transplants as well, and the information, the memories that's stored in the cellular fabric of the heart when it's transplanted. So I'm going to share the story, Glenda's story. "Oh my God, David, no," cried Glenda when she saw the bright lights headed straight for their car. As the squeal of the tires burning the grip of the road became one with her shrill shriek of helpless terror, she knew she had lost her husband forever. Moments before the car came crashing through the windshield, the couple had argued over something silly and had been sitting in resentful silence. Years later, Glenda sat with me in a dimly lit hospital chapel. At her request, I had arranged a meeting between her and the young man whose life had been saved by the gift of her husband's heart. The heart recipient and his mother were almost a half an hour late for the meeting, and I was ready to ask Glenda to leave. The issue of recipients meeting donor families is a sensitive one, and I understood why the man might have changed his mind. As I stood and took Glenda's hand, she said, "No, wait, he's here. I felt him come in 30 minutes ago. I felt my husband's presence. Please wait with me." Glenda is a practicing family physician. She's well-versed in bioscience and admires the rigor and healthy skepticism of modern science. Now, however, the power of something that transcends what science calls common sense was tugging at her heart. "David's heart is here," she said. "I can't believe I'm saying this to you, but I feel it." At that moment, the door opened and the young man and his mother walked hurriedly down the center aisle of the chapel. "I'm sorry we're late," said the young man in heavy Spanish accent. "We got here a half an hour ago, but we couldn't find the chapel." After introductions and awkward attempts at humor about a heart-to-heart meeting between a young wife and her husband's heart, the usually shy Glenda blurted out, "This embarrasses me as it must embarrass you, but could I put my hand on your chest to feel your heart?" The young man looked at me and then at his mother and put his hand to his chest and finally nodded his head. As Glenda reached forward, he unbuttoned his shirt and took her hand and gently placed it against his naked chest. What happened next transcends our current view of brain and body, heart and mind, but it has happened in various forms in the lives of the people and their families who've experienced the awesome force of a life system of one person being transplanted into another. Glenda's hand began to tremble and tears rolled down her cheek. She closed her eyes and whispered, "I love you, David. Everything is copacetic." I've read this so many times, it still makes me cry. She removed her hand and hugged the young man to her chest, and all of us wiped tears from our eyes. Glenda and the young man sat down in silhouetted against the background of the stained glass window of the chapel, held hands. Speaking in her heavy Spanish accent, the young man's mother told me, "My son uses that word copacetic all the time now. He never used it before he got his new heart, but after the surgery, it was the first thing he said to me when he could talk. I didn't know what it means. He said everything was copacetic. This is not a word I know in Spanish." Glenda overheard us. Her eyes widened and she turned towards us and said, that word was our signal that everything was okay. Every time we argued and made up, we would both say everything was copacetic. Our discussion about a magic word seemed to reveal a code of the heart within him, stimulated the young man to share story after story about changes he experienced following his transplant. Described by his mother as a former vegetarian and very health conscious, he now says he craves meat and fatty foods. A former lover of heavy metal music, he now loves 50s rock and roll. He reported recurrent dreams of bright lights coming straight for him, and Glenda responded, matter-of-factly, that her husband loved meat, was a junk food addict, and played Motown rock and roll while in medical school, and she too dreams of the lights of that fateful night. And in this book, there are lots of stories, not quite as detailed as that, but about this power that is just inherent in this, like, as he points to sort of the cellular memory, this electrical information that passes in the heart and resides there, the wisdom, the memories in the heart that does impact each of ourselves. And reading this, and was thinking about the times when my blood pressure was so high that it was really uncomfortable in the sense, like, well, no wonder it was such a mess of the sort of information that I would put a valence of sort of the fear and anxiety, and my own system was sort of going out in all directions, and then how to tend to it, you know, and this idea of how do we sustain and how do we tend this warrior heart of ours that can be so easily broken, whether it's through disease or allergies or exchanges of how it is just to be a human in this realm. So from David Wyatt's book, Essentials, he writes about heartbreak. Heartbreak is unpreventable. The natural outcome of caring for people and things over which we have no control. Of holding our affections, of holding in our affections those who inevitably move beyond our line of sight. Heartbreak begins the moment we are asked to let go, but cannot. In other words, it colors, it inhabits, and it magnifies each and every day. Heartbreak is not a visitation, but a path that the human being follows. Heartbreak is the beautifully helpless side of love and affection, and is just as much an essence and an emblem of care as a spiritual athlete's quick but abstract ability to let go. Heartbreak is how we mature. Yet we use the word heartbreak as if it only occurs when things have gone wrong. An unrequited love, a shattered dream, a child lost before their time. Heartbreak, we hope, is something we hope we can avoid, something to guard against, a chasm to be carefully looked for and then walked around. The hope is to find a way to place our feet where the elemental forces of life will keep us in the manner to which we want to be accustomed, and which will keep us from all the losses that other human beings have experienced without exceptions since the beginning of time. But heartbreak may be the very essence of being human, of being on the journey from here to there, and of coming to care deeply for what we find along the way. Heartbreak asks us not to look for an alternative path, because there is no alternative path. It is a deeper introduction to what we love and have loved, an inescapable and often beautiful question, something or someone who has been with us all along, asking us to be ready to let go of the way we're holding things, and perhaps preparation for the last letting go of all. This lovely notion, the truth of, in this realm, there will be heartbreak. Right. And it's not because there's something wrong. It's just the nature of things. All that we love, we will be separated from. It's this laws of impermanence, right? This nature that we are always in the process of changing. And with the changing comes our holding on in our loving and our losing, right? And the heart's response through the compassion and the heartbreak, right? We're going to get hurt, right? That's built in to this particular realm of being. So how do we work with this vulnerability? Yeah, that's just inherent in the system of ours. In Gabor Mate's book, Tomb, he speaks about the vulnerability, and I wanted to share, if we can get to the right page, in particular, the vulnerability that's difficult for all of us, and especially for men. In Terence Real's book, let me see if I can pull it up. Yeah, there we go. As I was saying, the vulnerability for all of us is so challenging when we want to sort of be braced and not be vulnerable. And for men, this in Terence Real, it's a great book. I don't want to talk about it. In our culture, we turn boys into men through disconnection. To learn to disconnect from your feelings, your vulnerabilities from others is what we call autonomy and independence. That's a traumatic wound, a hidden one, because it's culturally normative. It's almost pre-verbal. Terence Real speaks of male fragility and the denial of men's sensitivity. To me, fragility has to do with both the trauma and the injunction against being human. The essence of toxic masculinity is invulnerability. The more vulnerable you are, the more girly you are, the more invulnerable you are, the more manly you are. So the fragility of being human, the simple human vulnerability, is suppressed. Men are trying to live up to a standard which is inhuman, and they're dogged by a sense of falling short of that standard over and over again. He writes, the guys I all treat are captains of the industry who have done beautifully in the world and are horror stories in their own personal lives. I think for many of us, how we relate to our own vulnerability is so complicated, that both the reality and sort of my own experience of sort of the physical fragility of like, ooh, and I've been blessed with, my health has been mostly good. So this is the first time I'd had kind of a chronic illness to be challenged by. And that vulnerability that comes of how do we navigate this, and what do we lean to support in, and what is supportive to us, that on a physical level, in the myriad of ways that our physical bodies challenge us, present us with opportunities of practice and learning, and how do we navigate the times that are so stressful on a physical realm, in addition to our fragility in terms of the emotional realm and just how complicated it is in our lives right now. So how do we meet a vulnerability leaning into the practice, right, with a sense of courage, which is part of the parami of virya, energy, determination, and into wisdom. And sort of if there was a tagline for this talk, in some ways it would be sort of the warrior heart, how are allowing ourselves to be vulnerable and brave and courageous in order to move in the world in a wise way, that we need the wisdom of the heart and the acceptance of the heart's vulnerability, fragility, and profound courage and strength to be able to move into a wise place through the teachings of the Brahma Viharas, which we'll get to in a minute. I wanted to read just one from here. Again, in Gabor Mate's book, he quotes a woman, Jean Liddell, who talks about life develops as an expectation for its environment. Lungs develop in an expectation for oxygen. Cells develop in an expectation for oxygen. There is an inherent expectation, the wired in need, something that if denied interferes with our physical and psychological equilibrium. It gives the example of, say, you walk into a store to buy something and the clerk across from you maybe has a toothache or a crisis, but he looks at you solemnly, takes your money with a monosyllabic grunt, and brusquely hands you the change. Your physiology alters. You feel tension as your body tightens and your heart rate goes up and your breathing becomes more shallow. You're irritated. And depending on your own state of mind, you might feel angry or even imagining bad things happening to the sky. Why? According to the neuroscientist and researcher Stephen Porges, one of our inherent needs is reciprocity, to be attuned with, to be well met, as the archaic greeting goes. It's what he calls neuro-expectancy. Our brain may process the lack of welcoming response as an assault, a threat to our safety. That's a pretty subtle example. I mean, I'm sure we can all relate to the stores. We've been the clerk and we've been on the side of someone that's grouchy, or we're in a store and on the receiving end of someone who's grouchy, or just in our lives when there's an expectation that there's a reciprocity. When we don't get it, there's a jolt in the system. And when we're paying attention, we can catch like, oh, that happened. And I'm having this response. But sometimes things happen so quickly that it's an hour later and we're super irritated and we don't really know what happened. But being able to slow down enough, oh, wait, there was something missing. That the body's natural orientation through our neurology, our wiring, our heart is to have reciprocity. Yeah. That Winnicott's idea that there's no such thing as an infant. There's only an infant and the mother. They come together. That we are wired to be in relationship and conversation with each other. And when we're not, the system gets thrown off. And then how do we course correct when we're thrown off? How do we come back, attend to, oh, wait, can I come back to my own sense of congruence, my own sense of wholeness, separate from that, recovering almost from that jolt of what happened? And that takes courage, right? It takes courage to be able to turn towards that, ow, that hurt. And in that example, the stakes are pretty low, right? I'm buying something at a store. But the stakes can be so high in terms of when we turn towards the jolt, maybe in family relationships or with partners or with our kids, when the stakes are very high and that jolt can be traumatic, right? Whether it's sort of on the continuum of capital T or little t, how does the heart respond? How does the rest of this organism of ours respond when there's a jolt? And part of what's being required is, or let me rephrase it, through the Buddhist teachings, what we're being invited towards is to turn towards this part that has been jolted, that is unsure, that has been hurt. Turn towards it. Oh, what is this? To extend the sense of compassion towards ourselves. And that very act does require courage. So from John O'Donohue, he writes, courage. When the light around you lessens and your thoughts darken until your body feels fear turn cold as stone inside. When you feel yourself bereft of any belief in yourself and all you unknowingly leaned on has fallen. When one voice commands your whole heart and it's raven dark. Steady yourself and see that it is your own thinking that darkens your world. Search and you will find a diamond thought of light. Know that you are not alone and that this darkness has purpose. Gradually, it will school your eyes to find the one gift your life requires hidden within this night corner. Invoke the learning of every suffering you have suffered. Close your eyes. Gather all the kindling about your heart to create one spark. That is all you need to nourish the flame that will cleanse the dark of its weight and festered fear. A new confidence will come alive to urge you towards higher ground, where your imagination will learn to engage difficulty as its most rewarding threshold. Invitation of how can we work with our own courage to be able to turn towards that which has been destabilizing, that which has been traumatizing, that which has put our nervous system into dysregulation. And this can happen so many times in the course of the day. welcome. Another example of courage. Good Bones by Maggie Smith. Life is short, though I keep that from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I'll keep from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I keep this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible. And for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you. Though I keep this from my children. I'm trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful. And I think how we make that our place, our home, whether it's the divine abode of our heart, whether it's our literal physical home, whether it's the home of our community, our earth home, we could make it beautiful, but it does take courage. Yeah. One of my favorite books, Christine Feldman's Boundless Heart. Those of you who know I quote it from all the time. She writes about the courage of compassion, which is really what we're talking about, right? The courage to be able to turn towards our own heartbreak, our own suffering. The courage, the compassion to turn towards another's suffering, the courage and compassion to turn towards how can I make this world beautiful? How can I make this heart, mind, gut, the congruence of mind in our, each of us? How can we make it beautiful? Through courage. The courage of compassion is not always dramatic or heroic, but manifests in many smaller moments and ways. Courage is forged in the fires of the difficult. Confronting the causes of suffering may well bring exposure to unpopularity, judgment, and blame, which is difficult to bear. It is far more difficult to bear the echoes of disappointment in our hearts, born of turning away from a life where well-being and the end of suffering hinge upon our willingness to turn towards us. Compassion asks us not to be discouraged or disheartened by moments of dissonance. These are the very moments we are invited to reestablish our home and those deepest aspirations and manifest them in ways we engage with. Courage asks for perseverance, the willingness to realign our lives moment to moment with a compassionate heart. We cultivate and renew those commitments to healing, suffering, and uprooting the causes both inwardly and outwardly. And we know this, that this takes courage, and it takes the courage born out of a fortified heart. It's not something that we can do unsupported. And I want to read the introduction or the opening to this book, because I think she does such a beautiful job of laying out an introduction, although I know many of you may not need the introduction, to this notion of the divine abodes, the Brahma Viharas, right? Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Because it's these qualities, this resting in this divine abode that allow for us sustaining this warrior heart of ours, allows us to stand in a place of being lion-hearted, that the heart, there's a sense of balance and openness and commitment born out of a wisdom from abiding in this place in these Brahma Viharas. So I'm going to join me as I read this. There is no greater love. Well, first let me say this, because I love so much of how she writes, but in this introduction, she says the landscape and the embodiment of liberation. And just wanting to let that invite you into this notion of the landscape and the embodiment of liberation and Christina Feldman's very sincere invitation of this landscape is shaped by compassion, love and kindness, joy and equanimity. And the more we are able to embody these qualities, the more we can move along this path towards our own liberation. There's no greater love than the immeasurable friendliness that can embrace all beings, all events, and all experiences with unshakable kindness. There is no compassion greater than the fearless heart that can turn towards suffering and pain, tremble with empathy, and live with the commitment to end the causes of anguish. There is no greater happiness than inwardly generated joy and peace. There is no equanimity more unshakable than the profound poise of the liberated heart that can meet the world of ungraspable conditions and events without being shattered. Threaded through the entirety of the Buddhist pathway of awakening are the teachings on cultivating the boundless heart, immeasurable kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. These qualities are referred to as the Brahma Viharas. Brahma refers to the sublime or the noble tenor of these qualities. Vihara originally comes from the word monastery, or a place where we abide, a place that we make our home. We are encouraged, whether standing or walking, sitting or lying down, whenever we are awake, to make kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity the home of our heart. This is the noblest way of living in this world, here and now. Let's get a little bit. I'm going to read two poems and then lead us into a guided meditation. Be short. This is from Rilke. God speaks to each of us as he makes us. God speaks to each of us as he makes us, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear, you, sent out beyond your recall. Go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like a flame and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is the country they call life. You will know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand. I ask that you bear that image in mind. And then again, from David Wyatt. Prayer for an invitation. I pray for you, world, to come and find me, to see me and recognize me and beckon me out, to call me even when I lose the ability to call on you, who have searched so long for me. I pray to understand the stranger inside me who will emerge in the end to take your gift. I pray for the world to find me in its own wise way. I pray to be wanted and needed by those I have learned to love and those I must learn to love. I pray to be wanted and needed by those I cannot recognize in my self-imposed aloneness. And I pray to be wanted and needed by those I wish to be wanted by. But I acknowledge the power of your beautiful disguise, and I ask for the patient heart of all things to understand the abiding fear I feel in following your hidden and beckoning way in my fear of receiving, in taking your hand to follow its hidden, difficult, and forever beckoning way. So I invite you to close your eyes. Just take a minute. That was a lot of words. And just bring your attention back into your body. And if it's helpful, put hand to the heart, hand to the belly, or just notice the sit bones again, dropping the attention in the lower half of the body, feeling your feet. And if you're game, I'm going to ask each of us to take sort of a long inhale through the nose if possible for maybe a count of five. And then exhale on a count of, say, five or six. And just to allow I'm going to shape the breathing a little with these sort of longer inhales, longer exhales. And one more, breathing in, five. And exhaling, count of five. And if you feel comfortable doing so, to place both hands at heart center or over the heart. And just to allow in placing the hand here, sort of attention following the pressure of the hand against your heart center, to invite in and let your attention rest in this heart area, in this mysterious, wise heart of ours. That in its most pure form embodies these qualities of loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy, the crown jewel of equanimity that balances the heart. To let yourself feel this beating, wise heart of yours. Yeah. And for some of this, that may feel easy, accessible. For others of us, it might be harder. Okay. However it is, just allowing there to let the attention rest here, perhaps with this light pressure of the hands holding the heart center. And I'm going to ask you, to each of you, to call to mind someone you love, a place you love, an animal you love. This person, animal, or space may be alive or may have passed on. But to really allow yourself to drop in with all sense doors open, as you call to mind the image of, again, maybe a face of someone you love or your favorite place in nature. Beloved animal, notice how the heart feels. And then to open the doors, as it were, for other beings that you love, other animals you may have loved in your life. The perfect spot on the beach, the perfect perch on a rock with a beautiful view. A spot in the shade with your back against a redwood tree or a California oak. To allow the mind to bring in images that you love that are beautiful. To feel the heart and the mind in resonance as you open to the beauty, to the love. Notice how it feels in the belly. Are there certain words that come to mind? As you call to mind, as you allow in these faces of the beloveds, are there particular qualities? Oh, this person's generosity, this person's humor, the brightness in their eyes, this person's integrity, their honesty, their loving kindness, their capacity to forgive. Allow the attention to kind of dial in. What are the qualities of these beings who may have appeared? What do they represent? What do you love about them? This place that just might be so beautiful. When you're there, there is a resonance in your nervous system and the resonance of the natural environment. Oh, how does that feel in the heart? How does it feel in the heart when you call to mind the beloveds, the dear ones, and allowing there to be a fullness. Fullness of the heart, the vibrancy of this life force that we call love. That we would also call wisdom. The heart's natural movement between compassion and wisdom. The heart's natural resting place. A natural home that is loving, friendly, compassionate, joyful, and steady. How does it feel in the body to allow yourself to align with this truth? This natural capacity of the heart that can radiate out and touch all cells of the body, that radiates out at least 3 feet and is in conversation with all the other beating, radiant, pure hearts. How does it feel to imagine moving in the world from this place? This place of the open warrior's heart. So, thank you for your kind attention. I'm going to stop there. And then would love to open this up if you have comments, questions or comments, things you'd like to share, things that landed, things that didn't. I'd just love to hear from you. We have some time. And as noted, you could use your raise hand option. Also, if you don't want to come onto Zoom, you can certainly put your comment in the chat if you would like everyone to see it. Or if you would prefer to remain anonymous, you could send the chat to me or to Alana. So thank you so much. And I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks again for your kind attention.
Shakti.
Hi.
So I know it's kind of dark in here, but I can see you just fine.
Super.
I just wanted to express my appreciation for this because something interesting happened. I'm quite familiar with the Brahma Viharas but something about this process that you took us through by doing it through the heart center. I suddenly had this liberating feeling that dispelled some of the fears that I realize I hold about what will happen to me when I get older. And there's, you know, of the people around me, my husband's 20 years older, and I think I'm going to be alone and I'm disabled. So I have, you know, a chronic illness to manage, and I, you know, a lot of fears, like what's going to happen to me. But what what happened is I felt like as long as I have this practice to come back to and a community like this to come back to practicing with and these teachings to continue kind of coming back to my heart, and then this heart can connect to whoever is in my world. And it doesn't have to be the family that I have right now. It can be anybody that comes into my world. And so all of a sudden I felt this lightness of like, everything is going to be okay. I can release this fear that I realized was kind of, it's one of those things that kind of sat with me kind of deep inside that I was there. And every once in a while I would come across it and go, oh yeah, gosh, I don't want to think about that. You know, but so yeah, it was just a really profound experience for me. So yeah, the way you put that together just really, really worked for me.
Thank you so much for sharing that and the amazing power of when we can allow our fears to kind of move to the side a little bit and let the truths of these teachings come forth. So thank you so much.
Yeah, and being a fierce warrior, I think is really been my path as, you know, living with a disability, but also being a using that as knowledge to help other people.
Yeah, exactly.
Who have exactly. disabilities. And so, you know, I'm always using that as the sort of my thing to spread and be with people. So that's like, I think the fierce warrior for me really, really resonated too. So
thank you. So, and that like the sort of the definition of courage of, okay, I'm going to use this in order to help others, as one of the parmes, the perfections of the heart. So thank you so much for sharing that. I'm glad this was helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
And nice to meet you.
We have a question in the chat.
Please.
Can you elaborate more about what the meaning of warrior in warrior heart is, please?
Sure. In part, the sort of building upon what Shanti just shared, this notion of how I just wanted to think it through a little bit. I think it's being able to stand in the purest form of our heart that is both so preciously strong and vulnerable. And the sort of the synonym could also be the lion-heartedness. But what I like about the image of the warrior heart is the strength that it takes to be vulnerable, the strength that it takes to be wise, the strength that it takes to be courageous, the strength that it takes to be fierce in its honesty. And it makes me think of the Manjushara, who is actually behind me, you can't see, but sort of that sword of wisdom cutting through all the delusion. And there's, for me, there's a real warrior spirit in that of being able to stand so solidly. And this I know to be true. I know that there's the capacity to cultivate a sense of wisdom and compassion and vulnerability and honesty to be able to move in the world from that place in the heart and allow that to guide. And I feel like the warrior part, in its most divine sense, if that makes sense, as a way that this is so hard. It's not something that we can sort of stumble into, that it takes a real intention and commitment So that's sort of why I was playing with the notion of it being kind of a warrior aspect, and also in contrast to what are sort of common notions of what a warrior is, but the sort of the fierceness, the fierce compassion that also is embedded with a sense of vulnerability and honesty. So I hope that made sense.
We have another question in chat. Insights on the heart energy mechanics was new. Curious, from your personal experience, how this training, how do you feel heart-to-heart connection or resonance in your day-to-day life looks and feels like? Do you feel your heart in your daily practice?
Thanks for the question. And this might sound in a way obvious, but my blood pressure was so high, I could barely feel anything else. And it was so, I had never, and I feel like I have been really lucky to have never really had, this sounds so silly, but like I never really thought about my heart other than in doing all the practices, then I thought about it, but I never really paid any attention to the physicality of my heart until about 6 months ago, when I think about it all the time. But more not just the physical, but just sort of what does this mean? And it's really been a practice in the last 7, coming up on 8 months to really pay attention to both the physical, the emotional, the spiritual, the psychic, the electromagnetic fields of what's happening and how am I impacting it? And what is it that's around me that's impacting it? And in a way, so part because of it was attached to a mold allergy, there was an environmental sense. So there was sort of a scanning hypervigilance that came with it. But I think I do pay much more attention to it now in terms of how do I relate to others, to track it with these practices of really paying attention to being heart-centered. The Heart Math Institute has a lot of nice exercises and ways to work with it. But it does require an intentionality of practicing, whether with other humans, out in nature, to really feel that resonance where it's just a settling. I had the great gift to be in the river rafting in Idaho, completely off the grid for 6 days. And my whole system was like, oh, okay, this is a different way of resonating. But it does require an intentionality that for me came just out of necessity because of what I was dealing with physically. And I don't want to lose it. So I hope that answered your question.
We have another question in chat.
Please.
This one says, my heart doesn't feel very warrior-like right now. I have a pet who is dying. How do I bear it?
One moment at a time. And I say this having lost some very beloved animals in it's the line from Christina Feldman's book, like the magnitude of the task is no larger than the moment that we're in. The mind wants us to move forward and sort of scheme out, my mind has a tendency to want to scheme out and play out sort of worst case scenarios A to Z and doesn't help. And how do we bear it? Sort of coming back into it, it's this moment, what's precious, what's beautiful, and having enough support, both physically and in many ways support, but also the support of the practice, like how do we keep this heart that is made to be broken? We come into this world, we're going to love something, we're going to lose that. There's the grief is there, okay, making space for the reality of grief, watching when it's anticipating grief. What's it going to be like when? Ooh, bring the mind back here, right here. Can I stay right here? Can I stay close to this moment? And also training for in it as a companion to the grief, what comes in is supportive and beautiful so that the heart can stay open. And it's going through its own tenderizing process. And when do we need to take a break? To just really step out and have the sort of skillful distractions of skillful, healthy enough to really be able to let there be a rest or a break, to not just feel like we have to work with it all the time. Because sometimes, like, I'm done. And again, just when I was at a lot of, my blood pressure really was the worst at night. And I did a lot of Netflix meditation. So just sort of being able to take care and bring in that real self-compassion to what do I really need? What's going to be most nourishing? And, ooh, this hurts. Right. The undeniability of the pain born out of the love that you feel. So that's the natural movement of the heart. So I hope that was helpful. Yeah, and thank you for the comments coming in, and the Shimei, if I'm saying your name correctly, that realize why people use drugs to numb it, right? Like, or drugs or any other number of ways that we can numb out, and that sometimes we really do need a break, which maybe it looks like numbing, but just sort of being, to be able to titrate, and where do we go to take a break? Sort of what is nourishing, what is supportive? We can all have a list of things that are sort of the false refuges. But sort of where can we really tend to the heart when the heart is breaking, you know, whether it's the end of a relationship or someone's dying or we have a terminal illness or chronic illness, there's heartbreak. Yeah, it comes with a territory in this life. Okay, how can we meet it with wisdom and compassion? Thank you. Beautiful. Are there, just aware of the time, but if there are other questions, or how are we all doing? Thank you. Okay. If there's not another question, I have one more poem that I'd like to close with, which is from the first free women, Chitta. It's C-H-I-T-T-A, called Heart. Somehow I kept climbing, though tired, hungry, and weak, old too. At the top of the mountain, I spread my outer robe on a rock to dry, set down my staff and bowl, took a deep breath and looked around. It was windy up there. As I was leaning back against the large gray rock, the darkness I had carried up and down a million mountains slipped off my shoulders and swept itself away on the wind. So blessings to each of you. May all of our darknesses be swept away by the wind. If this was interesting to you, please join me in December. I'll be doing a day-long, just a more in-depth expanded version of this, which would be lovely to see you there. And thank you for putting my website up. So be in touch. Thank you for being with me tonight. Ilana, thank you so much for hosting us. Thank you, Spirit Rock. Stay safe, be well, and wishing your hearts much joy and delight. Thank you so much. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.